be a real healing. And a part of that healing was having an honest conversation with my mother. About a year before This Is Us started, I was with her in Gainesville. We had shot the pilot, and every day I questioned whether it would be picked up or if they would replace me. You just never know. As people I'd never met decided the fate of the show and of me, I was in limbo. So I had time to see my family. I went home to Gainesville for 5 weeks and slept in my old room. I was forced to be alone with my thoughts and to view my childhood through the eyes of an adult. One day I had just meditated when my mom appeared in the doorway. She asked how I was feeling, seeing as how emotional I had been for the last few days. I was dealing with a lot of anxiety, and I looked to prayer and meditation for solace. I felt as if something broke open. I wanted to ask questions and finally express to my mom some of the pain that I'd been carrying around with me for the past 20 years. "Why didn't you stick up for me?" I asked. "Why did I get treated differently? How come I was so often the afterthought?" She told me the truth, and it's hers to share. I will just say this. I got a better understanding of how desperate she was to keep the family together. To not have her children separated and put into foster care. She endured her own struggles with Trigger, and she worked incredibly hard to hide them. If I have Trigger to thank for testing my strength, I have my mother to thank for giving me her strength in the first place. Be mindful. Preschool rules still apply. I didn't go to college, but I sure did learn a lot about life teaching preschool. This was right after I graduated high school, and I was really excited about this job because it was an elite preschool that had a cutting-edge approach to learning. Every day there were different electives, and I got to see my students take part in music, dance, and art. It was hands-on, and it felt nothing like babysitting. The kids were on average 4 years old, and they, hands down, were smarter than I was at that age. There was a boy named Daniel who spoke so well. Miss Christie, I believe I'm a little damp, he would say when he wet himself. He always had me hollering. But even if the kids were more advanced than I was at their age, there were still fundamentals they needed to learn. And since, as adults, we're all just big kids anyway, I truly believe there are lots of us who could use a refresher. So, here are a few of those preschool basics that I taught back in the day. 1. Everybody helps clean up. I was fortunate that I co-taught with one of the lead teachers, Miss Lynn. She was a wonderful woman. She lived way out in the country, and I remember she kept this animal bone that was wrapped in a mass of horsehair. She had tied a huge rubber band to it so that she could bob it like some demented toy. What can I say? Kids love creepy things. She saved that tool for when the kids were getting lax about the rule about cleaning up toys. She had it behind her back at circle time. "Kids," she said, "this is what happens when you don't clean the dust bunnies underneath your bed." And she'd bounce this hair and jawbone thing at the kids as they screamed in delight. "You gotta clean up!" That did it. The kids jumped right up and began marching around looking for clutter. "We're gonna clean," they said. "We're gonna clean. Clean up, everybody, everywhere." What I loved about this rule was that it kept the emphasis on the positive, which is a focus in preschool teaching, and it should be in everyone's lives. The rule is not don't make a mess. That's unavoidable, either through your choices or your mistakes. But you always have the power to clean up after yourself and to help others do the same. I do this literally. I was at a Hollywood Foreign Press event the other day, and I saw two empty champagne flutes stashed in the pot of a plant. I picked them up and looked for a better place to stash them. Someone said, "Chrissy, you don't have to do that." Yes, I do. This whole life thing is a group effort, y'all. 2, work it out on the spot. If there was a fight or a misunderstanding about a toy or whose turn it was to do something, as teachers, we were taught to handle the situation right on the spot. That way, the children could communicate their feelings right away instead of lashing out later. "It hurt my feelings when you took my toy away." And the person then was given a choice of how to make things better right away, either give it back or find a way to share. As an adult, that just doesn't happen. You move on with your feelings or you harbor resentment. We rarely really deal with issues in a rational way on the spot. Hey, what you did just hurt my feelings. I want you to know. It feels awkward. It is too hard, but when you do, the person apologizes. Or maybe he doesn't, but at least it doesn't fester in your head. It's funny, because my biggest challenges at the preschool were the kids who bit and kicked because they couldn't communicate their feelings. And that's what adults do. Maybe you don't bite the guy you can't stand at work, but you lash out. I truly believe a nasty reply all is the grown-up's bite mark. Number 3, use your listening ears. I can't tell you how many times I was able to get my students' attention with, okay, put on your listening ears. Sometimes I would literally act like I was putting on my own. We all know how many distractions there are in the world. I look at my phone and it's like the jukebox display of alerts for all the things that need my attention that instant. But a lot of that is just static. The person standing in front of you, however, is not static. I see people acting as if they're engaged in full conversations, but they're just checking their phones the whole time. They might as well be saying to the other person, hey, whatever's on the screen right now, yeah, way more important than you. So many people, including myself, talk at each other, but don't listen to ourselves or to other people. Believe in actively listening to yourself. Take time to have a conversation with yourself every now and again. What's working? What could maybe use a little tweaking? So often we're on autopilot and we slip into addictive behaviors to avoid listening to ourselves. We eat or drink or, yes, check our phones. Anything to avoid hearing what we truly need to say. Number 4, do your best work. This sounds so simple, but people seem to forget it early on. When you know you did your best on something, you can let it go. If you find yourself obsessing over some lost opportunity or project that didn't go the way you wanted, being able to say, I did my best, is like an insurance policy against regret. And what I do, this is about preparation. If I don't make my responsibility my priority, I will feel ill-prepared, and it stresses me the F out. To memorize scripts, I physically write out my scenes again and again. I also use an app called Line Learner, which lets me record the lines of the people in the scene. I can selectively remove characters or remove myself, and I can run the lines. Number 5, worry only about yourself. Oh, honey, yes, God. You can become distracted by other people. The ones who are amazing on social media, juggling work and play, and doing it all with such grace. I don't even know if I have clean underwear today. Worrying about yourself wasn't exactly a rule in preschool, but it's something that was effective in the day-to-day policing of childhood jealousies. Kids are obsessed with getting their fair share, and quick to point out when they think someone got the bigger snack, the better color, or the first turn. How come she gets... The answer that always worked was, worry about yourself. As adults, we sometimes call this the compare and despair trap, where you look at someone else's life and become envious or feel inadequate. We can't know what other people have gone through or what's really behind that Instagram post. Number 6, raise your hand to speak. If you've ever been in a room full of children, you know that everybody has something to say that needs to be heard that second. And then there are the kids who are shy or who can easily get drowned out by others expressing, okay, yelling, their needs and feelings. Where do you fall? Are you sometimes waiting for someone else to voice your concern or needs? I was doing this video of a celebrity sing-along with a bunch of actors getting different parts of the song. I was told beforehand that I could choose any part of the song I wanted to sing. So I went with a chorus and a verse I liked. When I got there, they said, oh, can you sing this part instead? I didn't want to ruffle any feathers, so my first instinct was to say yes. But I said no, because I couldn't sing the part that they wanted me to. And the world didn't end. There have been times I regretted not raising my hand to speak up about something, but I have never regretted advocating for myself or someone I care about. Number 7, be a good friend. We would refer to the kids as friends as in, okay, give your friend a turn. So it wasn't so much about giving Marcus a turn, but just about doing what was right for their friend. Also, The kids then grew to automatically consider new students friends on arrival. Parents told us that if they were at a playground on weekends, they can invite kids that they didn't know to play with them by saying, "Friend, do you want to play?" As adults, we sometimes have a guilty until proven innocent approach to people. We make them prove their worth to us. But if we accepted newcomers to our lives as cool at the outset and then got to decide if they live up to our open-hearted expectation, I think we'd all be a lot happier. 6. You're here for a reason. You never know when the universe is going to say, "Hey, Miss Thang, you are not getting out of this one." When I was 20, I spent a lot of time babysitting my little sisters, Morgana and Abigail. They were friends with another set of sisters, Jenny and Annie, 4 preteen girls. Oh, Lord is right. Jenny and Annie's parents had to be out of town a lot, so I would sometimes spend entire weekends judging dance routines and stopping fights over whose turn it was to use the phone. One day we were listening to the local radio station when the DJ announced there was an open call model and talent search going on at the Holiday Inn in Gainesville. The same Holiday Inn where my mom met Trigger. The inn is happening. All 4 immediately started screaming, "Please take us. Just take us. Take us." "Well, how do you know it's real?" I asked. "I'm sure they just want your money." Morgana got in my face and looked right in my eyes. "Please, Chrissy," she said, "please." "Oh, fine," I said. There may have been cartwheels. We went, with Morgana and her friends all dressed up in what they thought models and singers wore. Morgana went into the audition room first, and I sat at the table outside to fill out the kids' forms because I was the boring adult for the weekend. I looked up to see this woman sitting across the table. She was white, in her 30s, and had a sweet face. She had an interesting brown hat tilted to one side. But what I really remember, more than how she looked, is how she made me feel. Like she was waiting for me. "I taught at Buchholz," she said. "I remember you." "Oh, wow," I said, thinking. "No, you didn't, crazy lady. You did not teach at my high school. Are you auditioning?" "No, I'm just here for my sisters," I said. "They wanted to." "You're here for a reason," she said. "You should audition." This crazy rando lady said it with such authority that I believed her. It was sort of a validation of something I already knew, but was afraid to admit. I deserved a chance, too. And as I was mustering up the courage to grab a form to fill out for myself, Morgana came out of the room with a woman in charge of the talent search. The woman, this oncoming force of fiery red hair and a brassy personality, looked right at me. "Who are you?" she barked. "I'm Morgana's sister." "Uh-huh," she said, nodding. "So what do you do?" In my heart, I was already singing my Disney princess voice. "I want to sing and dance and act and do everything." Instead, I just repeated, "I'm Morgana's sister." "Do you sing?" she demanded. "Do you act?" "I would love to sing, but I..." "Well, sing something for me." I said, "Oh, dear." I looked around, and the woman in that hat was gone. I went someplace in my mind, and I just started singing Reflection from Mulan. It's a song about not being seen, and also being afraid to show the world who you truly are. As I sang, she cocked her head like she was impressed. "Okay," she said, cutting me off. "I'll be in contact with you before we leave Gainesville." She and her business partner were based down in a small town just south of Orlando. When she called me and told me she wanted to be my manager, I said yes immediately. Her focus was on placing talent with agencies in Florida with the hope of eventually getting them signed in Los Angeles. She told me I had to come down to Orlando, where she and her partner were going to host an acting class for beginners. I didn't count on that. First of all, acting hadn't even occurred to me. I thought she wanted to help me become a singer. And there was also the drive. I was afraid to drive on the interstate. I'm talking white knuckle scared, like, which is ridiculous because honestly, the road between Gainesville and Orlando is only 2 lanes. "Chrissy, you put your big girl panties on and you drive to Orlando," she said. I did. And on the way down, I wondered what the catch was going to be. When I got there, the acting studio was just a room you could reserve for free at the library. There were about 20 people there, and my manager and her partner had written scripts for fake TV commercials for us to do cold readings. Cold readings are when you perform with little to no rehearsal. I really didn't like doing the commercials. I'd never done anything like this before. I didn't feel authentic. Just be yourself, my manager said. Just do what you think is the right thing. It was my first legitimate time reading a script, someone else's words on a piece of paper. I was scared out of my mind. But I did my thing, which meant nobody was going to be buying anything from me. I decided it wasn't about the product, it was about the performance. I played the role as if I were the town drunkard or a Brit from South London. I know, interesting motivation for selling soap. We're going to have to start writing monologues for you guys, my manager's partner said. This was exciting to us. And so the next few times we met, the teachers talked to us about our lives and wrote monologues tailored to us. They were steering me toward comedy and didn't seem to think singing was what I should focus on. After a few months of three-hour classes, the managers felt our motley crew was ready for Agent's Showcase in Florida. A manager sort of nurtures your career, and an agent procures the auditions. My manager and her partner made money coaching us and charging us for classes, then farming people out to Los Angeles and becoming known for having a great eye for talent. And they would also get a commission when actors booked gigs. They created a piece for the show called Inconvenience Store, and we all had different monologues. It was smart because they gave you ways to show different talents. I played the cashier, and as I was mopping up and talking to the audience, I sang Oleta Adams' Get Here If You Can. Our manager then auditioned the students to see who might be ready to represent at a talent showcase in LA. When I was picked, I was so excited. I had been saving up my money, so it was a big decision to gamble at all on this. But something told me to. Trigger and my mom didn't object. They couldn't help me with the fare, so I think they were just glad I could finance it myself. This was going to be my first time in LA. And it was cool just to be on a plane with all my acting friends. We were an army platoon preparing for battle. We'd be competing against other acting schools from all over the country. I competed for best dramatic monologue against at least 100 people. The field would eventually be narrowed down to the top three. My manager wrote my monologue based on conversations I had with her about growing up. She felt writing to our experiences was the best way to get authentic performances out of us. And she was right. She focused on my stepfather, drawing me out about the torment and the abuse I had experienced. The monologue was titled Celine Dijon, and my character had a stepfather who said she was too fat to ever make it as a singer. He called her Celine Dijon. It was frightening and freeing all at the same time to describe some of these upsetting moments I had never shared. I had hidden my childhood trauma, but now I could share it under the cover of my character. I came in second place in that competition, and it was such a huge deal for me. Something clicked. I began to envision a life for myself as an actor. I really thought I was going to be the female Jim Carrey. Like, who was writing the Mask sequel, and when do we start shooting? In December 2004, my manager asked me to officially become her assistant. I had been helping her out with all kinds of things for a while, but staying in Gainesville. The plan was that we would go out to LA for pilot season that January, and I would be her right hand as she and our respective agents tried to get me and six or seven young clients cast in network shows and commercials. When I gave notice at my preschool job, everyone there was excited that Miss Chrissy was going to go to Hollywood. I had a karaoke going away party, and my best friend Kristen and I sang Wide Open Spaces by the Dixie Chicks. People ask how I was brave enough to make the leap to go out for pilot season, and the truth is that I was desperate. I was bored with my life, and I knew that if I had stayed in Gainesville, it would be a vortex I'd never leave. I might have also been in denial, because I don't think I fully understood that I was leaving Gainesville for good. It felt like I was heading to summer camp. I don't even remember saying goodbye to my family. And I'm not sure if this was denial at work, making it easier for me to leave my mom. I thought I would just help my manager by submitting the girls' headshots and taking them on auditions. All the actresses who'd been coming out to California with us were just beautiful. What by then I knew the industry called marketable. I knew what that word meant. But I didn't understand how much size would play into casting until I actually got to L.A. The morning we left, we all met up in the Gainesville Days Inn parking lot. We were going to drive across country, caravanning in my car, and two vans driven by grandmothers carrying their granddaughters to Hollywood stardom. I would drive Leah, who I think was 15, in my little four-door Focus, and my manager would switch in and out of all the vehicles, pitching in to help drive as needed. At 22, I was the oldest of the actresses, with everyone else being under 18. Our manager gave each driver a walkie-talkie so we could stay in contact. When she handed me mine, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to drive across the country? Are you joking? I had barely made the trip to Orlando, which was 2 hours of straight-up white knuckles on that interstate. This was a 36-hour drive we were spacing out over 4 days. Who was this girl? As we were doing the final pack-up, the Napiers drove up. They were a family with a daughter and son who were both great actors. I didn't know why they were there because even though they were joining us in L.A. for pilot season, they were coming out as a family in a few weeks. They all came up to hug me. What are you guys doing here? I asked. We just wanted to see you guys off, said Mrs. Napier, and let you know that we're going to see you in L.A. Mr. Napier was kind of hanging back. He was a badass, beloved teacher at my old high school, and we all just loved him. He was a great teacher and an incredibly kind human being. He suddenly turned toward me and handed me a wad of cash. What is this for? I asked in surprise. It was $150 or so. I knew my mother could never give me that kind of money. I don't know, he modestly responded, in case you need it. My eyes welled up and I hugged him again. I was so moved. I knew every dime counted in Los Angeles, and I didn't have many dimes. But it was more than the money. Someone invested in me. Finally, we all took off on I-10. My best friend Kristen made me a mix CD of jams, so I popped that in. Daniel Bedingfield's If You're Not the One came on, followed by R. Kelly's Ignition. Lee and I did all the beep beeps and the toot toots on that one. As I drove, I became more confident. We got through Louisiana quick, but I remember Texas took forever. Halfway through, I thought, we should just turn around. We will never make it all the way through Texas. Eventually, we stopped in a tiny town to eat. The whole place might have been one street. Our manager was in my car, and she saw a shop that had a stuffed deer wearing overalls, sitting on a fence. Where in the actual hell are we? I said. Oh, we have to stop here, she said. She loved antiquing and weird stuff. When we got out of the car, we noticed there was the lightest layer of snow on the ground. It was like we had been transported to another world. The shop was fun, really country, with a lot of hand-painted salt and pepper shakers and plaids. And I remember it smelled like apple pie. Where are you girls headed? The woman sitting on the bench asked. I guess this was a place people only stopped at on the way to somewhere else. We're on our way to Los Angeles, I said. And one of the other girls chimed in. We're actresses. Well, stay safe out there, she said. Thank you, ma'am, I said. I meant it. I felt like I was on a crazy adventure, and I needed all the help I could get. I learned so much about myself in those 4 days driving across country, going through different states and cities that I'd never dreamed of seeing. At one point, there was a 5 or 6 hour period when Leah and I were in my car and the walkie-talkie stopped working. We couldn't get cell service either. I had my eyes glued to the vans in front of us, scared to death that I would lose them. Did I mention it was raining buckets? I was there with this teenager counting on me, and I didn't know what part of Texas we were in. I was the responsible adult? Oh, Jeebus. But it was so much fun. El Paso for the best guacamole of my entire God-given life, San Antonio for Bill Miller's Texas Sweet Tea travel mug, and some challenging civil engineering. Those roads are just loops. Every mile took me farther from where I'd been and closer to who I wanted to be. In Tucson, Lee and I got up early to pack just in time to see the most beautiful sunrise. We had the radio on in the car as we waited for the others. John Mayer's 3x5 came on, and he provided the perfect soundtrack. In that song, John's writing home to somebody he wishes could be with him as he travels. You should have seen that sunrise with your own eyes, he sings. It brought me back to life. And as the song ended, I thought, clear as a bell. Oh my gosh. This is the start of my new life. We could have slept through that sunrise. I would have missed the message. Just as that kooky lady at the talent search had said, I was here for a reason. Because showing up for yourself is sometimes the lesson. It's only a failure if you don't try in the first place. When you put one foot in front of the other, get through one walkie-talkie-free mile after another, you cannot fail. Your dream might evolve. You might see that something isn't meant for you, and that realization will lead you to what it is that you're really supposed to be doing. But until you show up for yourself with that first step, because I know that is always the hardest part, you will never know. I had to get on the interstate to Orlando and then drive across country. I had to conquer each fear so I could conquer the next fear. And the next one after that. Let me tell you, this wasn't easy, and it was something completely new for me. If your initial response when you think about your dream is, no, I can't, I'm too scared of what might happen, that means you're afraid to fail. And if you were being honest with yourself, you might even admit that you're also afraid of success. But whether it's the fear of success or of failure doesn't really matter. I think what it boils down to is that people are afraid of change. When I was sitting in that car watching that sunrise, I was present. I wasn't worried about the day's drive or how I was going to make it in Hollywood. I wasn't stuck in Trigger's kitchen being weighed. I wasn't waiting for Derek to choose me. I wasn't hoping for my father to love me. I was just present with myself. And I was enough for myself. It would be some time, we're talking years, before I learned the importance of staying present and not getting stuck by worrying about the future or lamenting what happened to me in the past. Acting has helped me so much because you must stay present. You can't worry about the next scene because you're in one this moment. It's the same thing in our lives. Just play the scene and see where it takes you. 7. These are the breaks. We couldn't contain our excitement when we crossed the border from Arizona into California. It was so MTV True Life, I'm going to Hollywood. Every city on the road trip had its own voice, and LA's was so big and loud that it made me speechless. There were all these cars in the freeway. Everything seemed intimidating and strange. Our new home would be Kenwood Mews, which is an apartment complex off of Hollywood Way in Burbank. Think Melrose Place with a random assortment of desperate hopefuls and a few working actors. We had a two-bedroom apartment and slept on air mattresses with three girls in each room. Our manager slept on an air mattress in the living room. There was a plastic table with plastic lawn chairs, and the table was covered with our headshots and resumes, along with a printer, highlighters, pens, and pencils. Our little makeshift pilot season proving ground. At night, we played Uno in between hoping for auditions, and all day we worked on scripts together. I would take the kids on auditions, wishing for callbacks and praying for the wild card. In the meantime, we had to budget all our money. Vaughn's, the supermarket, was a quick walk to save gas money, and our go-to was chicken fingers. It's always supposed to be sunny in Southern California, but every day that winter, it felt like there was a dang deluge. And thank God, because Subway had this rainy day deal that if you bought a 6-inch sub and a drink, you got another 6-inch sub for free. First sign of rain, we'd haul Boogie to Subway and get ourselves a free sandwich. At first, I was a driver, just taking the kids to auditions. And then as they booked gigs, I became what's called a set nanny, because an adult must be present on the set for a minor. So many actors lived in Kenwood Mews that on my way in and out, I would always see packages of scripts left downstairs addressed to actors whose names I knew. I would think, one day a script is going to be sent to me. But as the weeks went by, it felt more and more like no one was going to give me that chance. Yes, I had an agent, but that entire pilot season, I had two auditions. I didn't get either job. I had already lost 50 pounds before moving to LA, per my manager's suggestion, but it became clear to me that I should either lose more weight or stay the butt of the joke. Back then, there were even fewer roles written for people of size. You were a size zero or a sight gag. So how do you get a job without opportunity? I had no idea, but I didn't give up because I loved acting. How do you neglect something so firmly placed on your heart? I think when you stand out, and for me, it's as a plus-size woman, you think, how am I going to do this? And can I even conform? Why am I relegated to my dress size? I had to stop caring about what I wasn't and focus on what I was. Courageous, committed, and willing to sacrifice for something I wanted. As an actor, I got to be another person, relate to her plight, and lean in with empathy to understand her how and why. That's all I wanted someone to do with me. People know it wasn't easy for me to make it as a working actor, so I'm often asked for advice. All I can say is that you really must love it, and everyone's journey is different, but you have to have a real passion. That's true for whatever your work is, because that love is going to get you through hard times and long hours and the what am I doing with my life situations. My manager wasn't paying me enough to live on, and I rarely had auditions. By rarely, I mean twice. When my agent was looking for an assistant, my manager committed me without hesitation, or a conversation with me, for that matter. I was happy to have a real income so I could afford to get my own apartment with a roommate, which made the move to LA seem sort of permanent to me. I say sort of because there was never a closed chapter moment of transitioning from Gainesville to LA. I didn't even want to change my license plate for the longest time because that would make it real, and real was scary. But helping clients book acting jobs was like watching your boyfriend take another woman out every day. When I started working with the agent, I worried that if I screwed up, she was going to drop me as a client. But then we became very close, and the two of us ran the youth talent department together. As an agent, you are the liaison between finding talent and pitching them to casting directors and producers who can book them a job. If you represent kids who are minors, you also need to coordinate work permits, work hours, school hours, and Coogan accounts. Child performers are required to have Coogan accounts that save 15% of their gross earnings so that no thieving parents or unscrupulous folk can run away with the kids' money. And yes, you need to steer clear of the parents living vicariously through their kids. The goal is to eventually usher these actors up into an adult division or help them cultivate a career where they are not just actors selling fruit juice and laundry detergent. The first Christmas after I got to LA, I saved up to go visit my family in Gainesville. The whole time I was there, I was worried about an audition I'd managed to get for Hairspray on Broadway. Marissa Jarrett Winokur was leaving the show and they needed a replacement. It seemed like a chance at my big break, and the audition was happening in LA as soon as I got back. We were getting ready to go to Midnight Mass on Christmas Eve, and Morgana and I had been circling each other all day. She had been so bratty, and I think I was feeling my LA self. We have a tradition in our family in which everybody opens a present on Christmas Eve. Spoiler, it's always pajamas. We wear them to bed and to open presents in the morning. I'd gotten my mom a beautiful suede jacket in LA. It was perfect to wear to Midnight Mass, so I wanted to give it to her early. This did not sit well with Miss Morgana. Well, why does Mom get an extra present? I lost my mind. What are you talking about? I yelled. Morgana? Because she's our mom and deserves a jacket to wear to church? What's your problem? She said. You're such an asshole, I said. Why are you such a fat bitch? That kind of thing wasn't going to hurt me anymore. Yeah, you're right, I said. I am. This set her off and she lunged at me. As we fought, basically flailing our arms at each other, my mom began to yell, "Take this shit outside!" We did. Totally terrifying those neighbors, y'all. Brawling at Christmas. My poor baby sister Abigail piped up, "I thought we were going to church." Morgana went to swing on me like that front yard was a boxing ring. "I have an audition for Hairspray," I yelled. "Do not fuck up my face. I hate you." I was literally about to go to jail for committing sistercide. I was that mad. My mom came out wearing her jacket, which did look awesome. Thank you. "Get in the damn car so we can go to church. Jesus." Happy birthday, Jesus. My mom drove and I sat shotgun. The girls were in the back with Morgana to my left. And I could tell my mom was very upset. "Hold hands," she suddenly yelled. I do what my mother tells me. I reached back, and Morgana took my hand. Then something magical happened. That thing we now talk about every Christmas. We both said, at the exact same time, "I'm really sorry." "Good," said my mom. It was this authentic, genuine start to our new relationship. I went from thinking I could never even look at Morgana again to now talking to her 4 or 5 times a day. Just saying "hey" from the car or sending gifts and voice memos. She's a great mom to her 3 kids. She's been married 10 years. Looking back, I think we were playing roles. She was the diva, and I was the selfless sister, and there was always a fight scene. I think it's worth going off script with loved ones, maybe even acknowledging, "Hey, yeah, I know this is what we do, but can we just try something different?" For us, it was improvising to say, "I'm sorry." Trust me, that line was never in our scripts. I did just okay at the Hairspray audition. I know now that I wasn't ready. It's funny that that had been all I was thinking about over Christmas, getting that job. I got a sister instead. Pretty soon, my agent and I were the highest grossing department at that firm. And I enjoyed the work because I got to go scout the talent at different showcases for my boss / agent. This allowed me to sit in on acting classes and meet different actors. I eventually became an agent myself, and then I learned that it quickly becomes your life. It's basically a 24-hour on-call job, because there is always an issue you must resolve or break down to calm before the morning rush. The funny thing is, I learned so much about acting by being an agent. Some of my most important lessons and work came from those years, and I want to share them with you. Be mindful. How to be an agent of change in your own life. Trust me, I am not up here on the mountaintop preaching a sermon about what you better do and not do. These are life tips that are still life goals for me as I work to live up to my potential. I've tripped, bluffed, fallen, and aha'd my way to understanding them. I just feel the need to pay it forward. 1. Your mind is a garden and your thoughts are the seeds. When I was a talent agent, we had families who would remortgage their homes just to give their kids the chance of acting. Talk about pressure. But they understood that you need to be in the place where it happens. For acting, that meant the 2 hubs, New York and Los Angeles. If you want to nurture a passion, plant it where it has a chance to bloom. That's big picture as far as location goes. But it's also about choosing a school or a workplace that will allow you to grow. Ask yourself this simple question. Can I do what I want to be doing where I am now? We are so busy being comfortable and afraid to try for fear of being uncomfortable. When I wasn't making it as an actress, I told my mother that I thought I should just go home and go back to teaching preschool. "You'll be miserable," my mom said. "I'm miserable now, Mom." "Well, then, if you're going to be miserable either way," she said, "why not be miserable in LA doing what you love?" She was right. And I stayed in Los Angeles. Thanks, Mom. 2, be your own client. Personally, I know I am better at sticking up for other people and negotiating on their behalf than I am doing so for myself. It's something I'm still working on, so let's make a pact to do it together. It can be difficult to speak up for what you deserve, whether it's a promotion or a raise. So, make a case for yourself as if you were advocating for someone else. Don't talk about what you're entitled to because that's about emotion. State facts. What is your value to the operation? If you are responsible for a company or a project doing well, it's okay to say you deserve a little more of those dollar bills, y'all. 3, don't be a jerk face. Okay, I'm sorry, that wasn't an accusation. I know that you're lovely. I just mean that when I was an agent, aggressive shark-like behavior was thought to be an asset. There's a kind, confident way to stand up for yourself. And I find that like attracts like. If you are kind, you will work with kind people. My clients were nice people who showed that they were grateful to be doing work they loved. That's how you get more work. You can't keep anything you don't give away. Number 4. Lego your ego. Every once in a while, I would see a client resisting change. Finally, I would just have to say to the person, okay, these headshots aren't working. People aren't responding to them. Let's try another strategy. Your ego will try to tell you that adapting is the same as failing. Growth comes in when you can be objectively constructive. What isn't working? What could be better? Not right or wrong. The universe is knocking at the door telling you what you need to change so you can have what you deserve. But your ego is the surly bouncer trying to ruin your night, confirming you're not on the list. If you've been applying for positions or looking for investors but not getting them, take an ego-free, open look at your resume or business plan. Maybe ask someone to look at it with you. Sometimes all we need is another perspective. Number 5. Birds of a feather eat ramen together. When you're pursuing your dream, chances are you will be making sacrifices. Lots of them. Maintain a circle of friends who can cheer you on and let you crash on their couches if need be. When I couldn't afford acting classes, I read scripts with friends. We critiqued each other's work and got together to watch and discuss movies. We even paid for each other to get copies of headshots. It's not just about the lean times. You also want a support network when you achieve success. You need someone to check you, clothesline you, if you're getting too big for your britches, or if you're working so hard you forget to enjoy the life you've created. Number 6. No mud, no lotus. When I was an agent scouting talent, I loved meeting people who had a spark, but one that wasn't fully cultivated. I was always signing actors who were unconventional, layered, and interesting. There are some agents who only want to represent the easy sell, which is annoying, but I digress. For me, I wanted to give the underdog a chance. We were good. I was on the team that represented Ariana Grande just as she was going on Victorious, and also Dove Cameron from Liv and Maddie and Descendants. We represented Jordan Fisher of Hamilton, who brought home the mirror ball on Dancing with the Stars, and Hong Chau, who was nominated for a Golden Globe for downsizing the very week I'm writing this to you. And of course, Hannah Zeal, who plays 15-year-old me on This Is Us. I didn't get her the job. She's so talented she didn't need me. Think about people you can mentor in your profession. I truly believe that you only get what you give. It's a lot of work to invest in people, but the rewards are huge. There's a loyalty and a beautiful bond that can't be broken when someone knows you took a chance on him or her. Believe me, I know. Number 7, read the fine print. Seriously. I had to cultivate that side of my brain, and I could do it because it was for other people. Now when I read contracts, I know what to look for and what to ask for. I feel empowered. When I get the feeling someone is trying to breeze over details to get me to say yes, I simply say, before we go any further, I used to be an agent. You can't agent me. Oh, they say as they drop the facade. They stop pitching themselves or the company to me. When we're there on a level of mutual respect, we can just be real with each other. I can't stress enough how important it is to know what you're getting into and not put yourself at a disadvantage by refusing to look at the fine print in your rush to be liked. Number 8. What's yours is meant for you. I have friends who originally thought they wanted to be actors, but eventually chose to do other things. They just needed to be on a set to see what other dreams were available to them. They might have decided to become writers or producers, but if they never took that first step, they never would have known what their love really was. I believe that everything happens as it should. What is yours is meant for you, and you can maintain it, and there is an abundance for everyone. It's not always the journey we expect, but it's the one we need to take. 8. Woo me with your words. Hey, you know what's not fun? Being strong-armed by your friend into creating an online dating profile, especially in 2006. And especially when you thought you didn't need the interwebs to find a man. Or maybe you didn't even want a man. But my friend told me about a plus-size dating website where she had a profile. First of all, I didn't even know those existed. Remember, this was 2006, so online dating was still a dirty secret. Telling your friends or family you met someone online was like confessing to joining a cult. But my friend was insistent. Honestly, I should have known by how fast she raced her computer all the time that something was up. I later learned she wanted me to sign up to see if the guys who were talking to her would try to hook up with me, too. Okay, Carmen Sandiego, paranoid much? And so, I made my brief journey into the online world. 2 weeks exactly. Because that's how long it took for me to meet Marty. He lived in the north of England, and he was the mayor of Babeville. Beautiful blue eyes and a real, genuine smile. Marty was a journalist, an aspiring screenwriter, and a good one. Once we exchanged emails and talked on the phone, I was Dunskies. Put a fork in me, done. I told my mom and sisters right away. Oh, okay, was the consensus. Oh, cool. I don't think they took it seriously. When I told my friend I was going to remove my profile because I had met a great guy, she freaked. And the interrogation began. He lives in England, she said. Yes, I said, Sheffield. It doesn't matter where in England, she said, because it's another country. Eventually, Marty's going to come visit. Really? She asked. Has he seen all of you? I knew exactly what she meant. And yes, he had seen my size, curves, number on the scale, stomach, and still chose to write beautiful, poetic emails I woke up to every morning, without fail. I still have them printed in a binder that I would love to publish one day. For 7 months, we emailed, called, and sent letters, cards, and pictures. I loved his voice and his accent. I fell truly, madly, deeply in like. It wouldn't be real love, I promised myself, until he showed up. And then he did. I went to pick him up at LAX, and it was exactly like in the movies. I had been so nervous, and when I saw him, I thought, there you are. He was the one I had been wanting for so long. He and I were suddenly the only two people at the baggage claim, and time stood still. I'm talking like the romantic movie scene you thought never actually happened. He was supposed to come for 2 weeks, but he extended his ticket so many times. A month, then a month and a half, 2 months. We just clicked and had so much fun. It was his first time in America. He loved music, but especially hip-hop. So he had seen all the pictures, movies, and documentaries about it. But to be in California, the land of Tupac and Snoop, was amazing for him. Also, he was from this coal mining town in the north of England, and now suddenly there's all this sun. I got to experience so many LA firsts again. We went to the beach in San Diego, and I introduced him to Mexican food. When he left, it was an emotional goodbye, to put it lightly. I was sobbing on the way back to my car, crying so much that an airport employee with a kind face quietly said to me, "Don't worry, he's gonna come back." How did he know who or what I was crying about? It was just what I needed to hear. Marty's plane hadn't even taken off, and I already missed him desperately. It's funny how people talk you out of happiness. "You need to go to England, Chrissy," a friend said. I agreed, but then she added why. "Make sure he doesn't have a wife and a bunch of little Martys." I knew he didn't. We went on like this for almost a year, with him always coming to me in LA. We had no money, but it didn't matter. We clicked creatively, and we loved each other. We took that day trip to Montecito, the one where I, you know, manifested knowing Oprah and visited Butterfly Beach right by the Four Seasons Biltmore. It was like an ad for your dream California vacay. We took the 101 to this beautiful place, palm trees lining the beach. It's a hidden gem with no more than a handful of people walking the sand as the tide rose. "We'll come back here," he said. We did. We went back a few months later, after we had dated just over a year. We parked the car on the shoulder of the road just as the sun was setting, so we rushed down to watch it. He ran just a little bit ahead of me. "Okay, hold on," I said. He turned around fast and was suddenly down on one knee. "Chrissy, will you do me the honor of being my wife?" Did I say something poetic and beautiful? Something along the lines of, "Yes, I want to go through this life's journey with you at my side. I want us to be together as we grow into the people we want to be." "No," I just started yelling. "Wait, wait, what, what?" I stammered. Are you serious? Like, seriously serious?" He looked confused, so I managed to sputter out, yes, of course. We had talked about getting married. It just seemed natural, since we had never felt this way about another person. But I never expected that he had saved money to get me a ring, or that it would be so soon. Back then, I would never presume someone would be working in secret to do something to make me happy. After the hyperventilating subsided, I made the first call to the person I knew who would understand my happiness. "Grams," I said, "Marty just proposed. We're engaged." "Congratulations, my darling," Grams said. "I'm so happy," I said. "Oh, honey, that's what matters, and I'm so happy for you." My family was so excited, and my grandma wanted to plan the wedding with my sister Monica. They envisioned all of us gathering in Florida, but we couldn't afford to fly out, and they couldn't afford to pay to bring us there. No one in my family had even met Marty because we couldn't afford to visit Gainesville. I told them I would just have a simple January wedding in Santa Barbara on Butterfly Beach. Just us, the officiant, a photographer, and the tide as it rose. I think they were really crushed when I told them we couldn't afford to come to Florida for a wedding, no matter how small they pictured it. So, I reached out to Mark, my biological father. I had his email address. "Hey, I just wanted to let you know that I'm engaged. He's a great guy, and we're going to get married." I paused at the keyboard, then swallowed my pride and continued typing. "I don't know if there's any help you might be willing to give us or anything you would like to talk about." I pressed send before I could second-guess myself, and I pictured him reading the message and being happy for me. I assumed he'd write back, "Chrissy, I'm not in a financial position to give you money, but I wish you the best." That alone would have meant something. He never replied. I didn't anticipate how lonely I would feel planning the wedding for just the two of us. Just me and Mr. Wilson, stranded on Gilligan's Cryland. My sister Monica would send me pictures of wedding dresses with the subject line, "Cute, maybe?" I loved the dresses, of course, but I wanted her to be there. I wanted to have a shower and all the things a girl wants to share with her sisters, her grandmother, and her mother, crying and laughing while we all made couture wedding dresses out of toilet paper. I wanted a cake and paper bells and fancy napkins. Yes, well, she's getting married. Let's all celebrate. Saturday, January 5th, our wedding day, we woke up in Montecito Inn to a torrential downpour. The Los Angeles Times headline was, "Storm now has its eye on the Southland." 1,000 homes in Orange County were being evacuated, and 1 million people had already lost power. There were 4 inches of rain and hurricane-force winds. And an outdoor wedding. We moved it to the Santa Barbara Courthouse, which is honestly beautiful if any of you ladies or gentlemen are getting married there. It's just not what my heart was set on. It was freezing that day, and I had a short wedding dress. When I left the hotel to get my makeup done, I stepped off the curb, and my sandal slipped off. And there it went, floating away with the river of rainwater down the storm drain. I had to go back to my room for another pair of shoes. All the things that girls dream their wedding will be seemed to float away with that sandal. That was okay, I told myself, because honestly, Marty and I loved each other deeply, and as long as we were together, that was all that mattered. Okay? Okay. We raced into the courthouse, and as we were dripping and freezing, the clerk gave us a pitying look. "Congratulations," she said. "Just so you know, when it rains on your wedding day, it's good luck." "What about a deluge?" I said. "What about a tropical storm? What does that mean?" The ceremony took only a few minutes. We had dinner at a restaurant next to the hotel and spent the night at the Montecito Inn. That would be our honeymoon. I wish we could have done a real honeymoon, but when you're struggling financially, you're not going to have that. We had each other, and that was enough. And we had food. Marty was a big guy, and he had gained weight right before we met. We enjoyed each other's company, and we gained the weight that many couples gain when they're just happy together. But I wasn't aware of how much weight I had gained, and soon I had put on 30 pounds. I was working 60 hours a week as an agent while he worked part-time so he could pursue his dream to be a screenwriter. I paid the majority of the bills, so I put my dreams on the back burner. It was easier to say my acting career was never going to happen than to try and fail miserably. Marty also made it clear that he didn't really vibe with the personalities of performers, which were basically all the people in my circle of friends. It's not that my friends were always on, but they were funny and their comedy was broad and bold. He felt we were all trying to one-up each other, getting some bigger laugh. His distaste for performers was awkward, because being one was still my dream in my heart of hearts. I was averaging 2 auditions a year, and in 2009, I landed a role on an episode of My Name is Earl, playing a cheerleader named, guess, Chunk. So I spent a chunk of the money on a trip to Florida. My family and I split the cost of a condo for a week of vacay so they could finally meet my husband. And they did not get along. Look, nobody got crazy or anything. It's just that Marty's quiet and reserved, and my family is the opposite of quiet and reserved. You have to fight to get a word in edgewise. And they expect you to keep up. They liked him, but when he didn't say much, they weren't sure that he liked them. It just never clicked. He felt crappy, they felt crappy. Me too. I felt both sides were being judged, and I was so protective of them both. A highlight of the trip was going to visit my grams and being able to say, "This is my husband, Marty." We spent 2 nights with her, and it was so wonderful. All she wanted for me was to be happy, and Marty responded to that. He thought she was lovely and kind. Back in LA after that vacation, I learned an important lesson about marriage. Be mindful. The Shrouded Supreme. For the first 2 years of my relationship with Marty, we ordered a lot of pizza. I worked a lot, and who doesn't enjoy 2 of the greatest man-made inventions? Pizza and delivery? Ah, the Supreme, he would say every single time. And inside, I would think each and every time, oh God, that comes with bell pepper. I like olives and onions, but I don't do the bell pepper. But I would say to myself, Chrissy, marriage is about compromise. If he liked them, I could pick them off, no bigs. One day, a ridiculously long time into our Pizza Supreme eating relationship, I noticed he knocked a couple of the bell peppers off. I mean, who was this man? Do you like bell peppers? No, he said almost guiltily. What? Why, I order them for you. I order them for you. It took years for us to realize that. For years, we were treating each other with such kid gloves that we were afraid to say, "Hey, babe, I don't like the bell peppers," or communicate effectively by asking, "Can you make your half supreme and I'll just have olives?" It was a lovely sacrifice because we did care about each other so deeply, but at our own expense. I think you have to take a peekaboo look at your pepper ruse. The things you put up with in romantic relationships and friendships. It's okay to say, this isn't working for me, or I don't like this. Because your friends and significant others probably want you to be happy, right? Unless they're sociopaths, in which case R to the U to the N. Whatever your bell pepper is, if you are doing something or putting up with something because you love someone, consider checking in with that person to make sure that is really love in action to him or her. Because you are not the authority on what makes others feel loved. They are. Ask them. 9. Lost Angeles. You know that terrible moment when you realize your car won't start? The ignition just won't turn? You are certain that if you give it a second, the car will change its mind, but it doesn't. Welcome to the summer of 2007, when my trusty Ford Focus was trying to tell me it was tired. It had gotten me to LA and carried me through my first 2 years there. But it had decided the parking garage of the agency where I was a junior agent would be a good place to die. The funny thing is, the lights still worked, and the radio. My car was a lot like my life at the time. The lights were on, the music was playing, but something wasn't clicking enough to get the car moving. I had to get it towed, but I wasn't ready to say goodbye. The problem was that I barely had enough money to pay for the tow truck, let alone get a new car. It was the ignition switch, and I discovered, just from desperation, that if I shimmied the key in the ignition just so, I could still get it started. The magic number was 14 times. I wasn't giving up on acting or Los Angeles, and I wasn't